Hello, welcome to the podcast. I'm the host, as usual, Ian Lewins, one of the consultants in the Children's Emergency Department in Derby. And I'm very pleased to be joined tonight by Dr. Ian Wacone, who's a consultant paediatrician from Birmingham and is also the edition editor for Education and Practice, the edition of Archives of Disease in Childhood. Good evening, Ian. How are you?
Good evening. How are you? I'm very well, thank you. I'm, as I've said, I'm on call. So, hey, let's hope we get through this.
Yes, we'll see what happens. And we thought we'd talk, it's that time of year, it's November in the UK, it's winter is nearly here with us. We thought we'd talk a bit about bronchiolitis. So, well, let's take things very much back to basics for those sort of new to paediatrics. What do we mean by bronchiolitis?
Okay, well, obviously, if you were a histopathologist, you'd say it's itis of your bronchioles, so inflammation of your small airways. But of course, that implies that I would get bronchiolitis, and I don't. I probably get itis of my small airways, but I don't get the same symptom set. And what we mean is a cluster of symptom sets that's actually very clear to anybody who's spent any time in an emergency department or working with children or on the wards with children at this time of year, which is a presentation of a viral illness, runny nose, generally a miserable child who parents might say is off the feeds, is crying a lot, perhaps a little bit of wheeze, quite a lot of cough. And then when you examine them, they've got a cluster of features of increased respiratory effort. So that could be tachypnea, fast breathing, could be intercostal, subcostal, sternal recession, all of those various different things.
So, and you know, this time of year, we get very familiar with these children. They sort of get diagnosed almost as they walk through the door with the wet cough. And
it gets to the point for me where there's usually a day sometime in December where I listen to a child's chest, can't hear crackles, and think that I've probably gone deaf, and then realize it's the first child without bronchiolitis that I've seen in a month and a half.
Yes, that sounds about right. And these are typically young children, aren't they? They're typically the sort of under ones.
Yeah, definitely. So if you were going across to the United States, you would technically define bronchiolitis up to 2 years. But in the UK, we usually stick with under one. I think most people would recognize that if you see a child who's full of virus, who is, say, 6 weeks old, they're qualitatively quite different to a child who's 11 months old and definitely different to a child who's 23 months old. So I'm kind of comfortable with saying, yes, they're under ones.
Yeah. And typically in our winters, but you can see bronchiolitis throughout the year, can't you?
You can, and any of the viruses that would give you a cough or a cold can give you bronchiolitis, and as you know, you get summer colds, so yes, you can get summer bronchiolitis. Important, though, obviously, to think a lot more closely about the differential diagnosis when you're seeing a child out of season who you are concerned might have bronchiolitis. You've got to think, am I missing something else?
So making the diagnosis tends to be fairly straightforward. They tend to have fairly classic symptoms. And of course, the great temptation when you're seeing this snotty, wheezy child whose parents are exhausted is to want to do something. What can we do?
We can be kind. And we can be supportive, but what we mustn't do is kid the parents that we can do a whole bunch of things and maneuvers that actually really improve things that don't.
And you know, the temptation, of course, is to say, "Well, I'll just try some bronchodilator. Maybe I'll give you some salbutamol. Maybe I'll give you some Atrovent." But that's not necessarily the right thing to do at all, is it?
It's specifically not the right thing to do. On two levels, for example, there's good Cochrane review level meta-analysis evidence that bronchodilators of any sort don't really work. And there's sort of theoretical evidence that actually if you've got a child who's potentially stenting open their airway with a small amount of smooth muscle control, an older child with a bit of laryngomalacia, a slightly floppy airway as well, that can paradoxically worsen the child. So yes, you don't want to give these children bronchodilators. And I mean, I don't know if you've ever experienced bronchodilatory, and I don't know if you've ever felt the need to have a little puff on your own nebs, but it you know, it's a methoxanthine. It gives you a bit of it kind of gets you a bit wound up. We've all looked after children who've spent a night on very high dose methoxanthines really jittery. So it can make you feel pretty unpleasant as well. So yes, we should avoid it where possible.
Yeah. How about then, okay, so if we can't give bronchodilators, how about steroids? Because we give steroids for things like croup, and we give steroids for children who've got exacerbations of their wheeze. So how about steroids for bronchiolitis?
Good question again. Unfortunately, good evidence that it's completely useless.
Okay, so we can't give steroids, we can't give bronchodilators. How about then hypertonic saline, nebulized hypertonic saline? That sort of seemed to come into fashion a little while ago.
Yeah, so it did. I have to say that for a period, I was convinced by the evidence. I thought that the meta-analyses were tending to give us positive evidence. We took a pragmatic decision to remove it from our guideline at Birmingham Children's Hospital when NICE published its first bronchiolitis guideline, must be 4 or 5 years ago now, and said actually, in their view, the evidence was not positive for it. And to be absolutely fair, we haven't seen a significant increase in pathology, and we haven't, and our nurses prefer it because it's a pain giving the nebulized salbutamol every 6 hours. And I have to say, I mean, there's a part of me that thinks, oh, you know, last time I had a cold, would I like somebody to nebulize some seawater at me? No, I don't think so. So there's a part of me that sort of intuitively agrees with this as a negative thing, but I shouldn't allow my biases to come in quite as strongly as that.
Okay. So that's another no. I'm sure I've seen somewhere from the American Academy of Pediatrics, they talk a bit about nebulized adrenaline for sort of severe bronchiolitis. Is that something that you use routinely at all? Or?
No, we don't. And I've not seen it used. I think the thing with, I do find that evidence a little puzzling because, again, so Cochrane seems to be slightly more in equipoise about that. The NICE review of it would suggest that we shouldn't use epinephrine adrenaline in bronchiolitis, but I've often wondered whether this is something to do with the if you like, the sort of the structure of practice in the US. So, for example, you are an office-based primary care pediatrician. Your child rocks up with some bronchiolitis, and therefore you do some manoeuvres that give you a short-term improvement. So most of improvement that we're looking at is things like length of stay and symptom sets. Whereas if you're an office paediatrician, you're not looking at length of stay because you're not admitting the child. So I wondered whether that might be it, but we certainly in the UK it's not recommended.
Okay, so is there any evidence that any treatments make a difference?
So there's making a difference, meaning getting the child better fast, or making a difference in terms of supporting the child. So we would, supportive therapy is the key thing. We know that there are some things that make children worse. So we know that excessive handling of the child makes the child worse. We know that, for example, something that feels intuitive, and in fact, I had a fairly robust conversation with a mother on the ward round just earlier about this, which is nasal suction. You know, people think, all right, well, I'll just suck out this poor little mite's nostrils and maybe they'll be able to breathe better. But unfortunately, there's not any good evidence that that's useful. NICE recommends it only in the situation where you've got apneas, where the baby's stopping breathing. But otherwise, as I put it to my colleagues, when I've got a cough or cold, I don't really want you putting a hose pipe up my nostrils.
Quite. And in terms of, you know, routine investigations, chest x-rays, blood gases, do they have a role?
Routine investigation, so a blood gas is very tempting. And I suppose that's one of the less harmful things, although that always seems to show a slightly high lactate, which is kind of annoying because you then have to chase that down. I remember a conversation many years ago with Howard Buckner, who used to be my editor-in-chief at Archives, and he talked about the fact that his guys used to do, he said, do you have this, I won't do the American accent because it was terrible and I was criticized for it earlier, but he said, do you guys have the same that we do? Everybody does x-rays and they see schmutz on the x-ray and then they have to start antibiotics because the child's got schmutz. And I've always thought that that word schmutz is very helpful because it shows you that this idea of just a bit of clag on the x-ray, which you're sure if the child had a cough, it would probably move to somewhere else. It's probably just simple atelectasis, tiny bits of collapse of the lung that are just going to reinflate again. What we say is basically, if you think it's not bronchiolitis, or if you think it's bronchiolitis plus something else, then of course you can investigate. So if the child's got a temperature of 39.5 and seems to have respiratory sepsis, well, of course you can do a chest x-ray, and of course you can start doing a full blood count and perhaps doing some U's and E's and CRP and all of that sort of stuff if you want to do that. But if you think that it's bronchiolitis, then it's a clinical diagnosis, and at that point you don't do any further testing.
Okay. Now, you and I have seen, I suspect, a reasonable number of bronchiolitis seasons, and you and I kind of know what to do and not what to do. But I guess one of the great challenges in the emergency departments when you have people who are new, who rotate round, is making sure that they know what to do, and more pertinently, I guess, what not to do. Which kind of was the sort of lead into to doing this podcast, was that you tweeted something of, here's how we are going to try and make sure that everyone is doing the same thing, and probably, again, everyone's not doing the same thing. What was that all about?
Yeah, so you know, I've developed our bronchiolitis guideline with lots and lots of help from lots of colleagues over the years, and each year I sit and sort of try and refresh it. And the thing that really struck me this year is how many sort of conflicts we set up within our healthcare system, not deliberately but inadvertently. So, for example, you've got the parent, the nurse, potentially a physiotherapist, sometimes a senior nurse. We've got outreach nurses from our ICU. We've got our ICU doctors. We've got our hospital at night on call doctors. We've got our ward round doctors, and they're all. They're all concerned to do the best they possibly can for the child, obviously. I mean, that's why they get up out of bed to come to work, obviously. But we set them up into sort of a conflict. So you've got, say, for example, you've got a parent and the nurse are concerned about the child, and that's great. And so you need to come and review the child. Or you've got a nurse who's not that experienced, but thinks that everything's okay, but you just want that child reviewed for reassurance, which is also completely reasonable. So then up rocks the doctor and thinks, well, I think everything's okay as well, but I kind of have just got to do something, haven't I? I've just got to, maybe I should just fiddle. Maybe I should just add something in. Maybe I should do something. Now, I had a conversation with Ian Sinner, who's a respiratory pediatrician in Alderhay, and not in real life, obviously, I don't get out enough for that, but online. And he was talking about something they talked about called sitting on your hands. And we came up with this idea, time to get better, which is a sort of a really bad dad joke pun, because basically you and I both know that the key thing in bronchiolitis is giving the child time to get better. The child gets better in spite of us, not because of us. And then this idea in general that it's time for us to get better at doing bronchiolitis. And so this is a series of, this is a care bundle, which is a series of ideas wrapped around the child that if we can deliver all these different things and give people the confidence that, okay, we don't need to escalate, we don't need to handle this child loads and do lots of tests and start lots of medicines, we can be comfortable that the child is going to work a bit harder, that we can be comfortable that the child is tolerating some feeds and isn't just being hungry, and we can minimize the amount of additional oxygen and respiratory support we get, then we give the child time to get better and we can all talk the same language.
And what sort of format does this care bundle take? Is it a physical thing? Is it an electronic thing?
It's basically it's a sort of a an A3 printed sheet, laminated, which I have scattered various places around the hospital. We've got a paediatric assessment unit, which is a 19-bed unit where 16 cubicles, and there's a copy of it in each cubicle. So I'm hoping that the parents are reading this and saying, okay, I get that why you've restricted my child's feeding. Actually, now I think my child's getting a bit better, so why can't we try a bit more? Why can't we get that nasogastric tube out? Because it says here that you can take the tube out as soon as it's not being used anymore. And so,
okay, so it's aimed at parents as well as healthcare professionals?
It's aimed at anybody who's involved in looking after the child. Yeah, so parents, healthcare professionals, grannies, and grannies coming in and visiting. Everybody needs to. Like I said, the main thing is, if we set up a conflict, then people feel it's necessary to do something. And I'm keen to avoid that conflict and say, actually, not doing something and watching and making sure that baby's safe and supporting them, that's actually very important as well.
So is that something that you've now rolled out immediately?
Yeah, that's up and running at the moment in our organisation. I did the ward round earlier, a couple of cubicles. The laminated posters seem to have gone missing, but hey, found another couple, stuck them up again.
And are you going to sort of look back at the end of, in spring maybe, and sort of assess whether this has made a difference? And if so, how are you going to measure that difference?
That's a good question. So I'm not an academic. I don't have, even though I edit with archives, I haven't got, haven't ever been a PI or anything like that. So I thought about doing this in a sort of a terribly sort of highfalutin academic way, but actually the key thing for me was just attempting to improve the quality. Now, what we are going to try and do is, We use this concept called micro audit. I don't know if you've come across it, but it's very, very small, very easy audits where you pick five or six items and just put a tick or a cross over 10 observations, so that then you can make a very easy percentage. And so we can look at really simple aspects of this and see whether we're achieving it. So you could look at the next 10 patients and say, did we manage to avoid doing a chest x-ray on this patient? Did we manage to avoid doing blood tests? Did we unnecessarily restrict fluids? And just go one or zero, tick or cross, and then say, okay, feed that back the next day on the ward round as a sort of this micro audit, and then say, okay, so why is it that we're doing so many chest x-rays? What's causing that? Is it part of our relationship with our emergency department? Are we not communicating this well enough with our colleagues there? Or have we got some unmet need that we're not understanding? So it's that sort of iterative approach that about implementing the guideline, the care bundle that we're looking at, actually assessing whether it saves us masses of money, loads of time. Well, you know, I think if there was something that halved the length of stay of children with bronchiolitis, I think we'd already have guessed and worked it out by now. But for me, in our organization, we have between, I don't know, 200 to 400 children a year come through as inpatients with bronchiolitis. So if I can shave off half an hour or an hour of all of their stays, just get them out of hospital slightly sooner, safely, but slightly sooner, that's a significant help and improvement to the bed pressures that we'll face over the winter.
Yeah. And Sydney, I saw when you tweeted this idea, actually there's quite a strong and positive response to that. Can people access this, or is this sort of specific to Birmingham?
So absolutely, I'm very happy to share this. I don't feel any kind of any significant ego in it, except, you know, obviously if you rip it all off, I'd quite like you to say, oh, Birmingham Women and Children's Hospital, that's great, you know. If people want to email me, Ian Wacone, all one word, at nhs.net, or that's also in the front of archive, front of Education and Practice, if you want to have a look there, that's where my email address is. Very happy to share the link to, I've got it all in a Google Drive, and you can download the PDF of our poster. And also I tend to sort of share some thoughts about how we implemented it as well. Because of course, you know, I'm I'm not doing this as a one-man band. I've got loads of support from colleagues, and my every iteration of the guideline is hugely reviewed, especially by my pediatric ICU colleagues, who like to take a very close eye at any suggestions like this. But obviously people need to understand that the suggestions that we make I'm not Cochrane, therefore they need to sort of think about, okay, does that look rational and real to me, and do it on their own, take on the care bundle, not at their own risk, but actually, you know, and not totally indemnifying me, but basically basically saying they don't think it's mad.
Yeah, but I think, you know, the amount of response that the tweet got suggests that there's clearly a potential unmet need here.
Yeah, it really felt like I was pushing against an open door, actually. One of the really interesting things in that I noticed, this is a new thing that I spotted. I don't think I'm unique in spotting this, but I tend to think in kind of, if you think of a generation in medicine, say you think of a generation, you say, well, maybe 10 years. Okay, so the stuff that you and I know today, it was different 10 years ago. And the guys who are 10 years, the guys and ladies who are 10 years behind us are sort of generationally different. And I've thought of wards like that. But what I realized in doing this was that actually some of my most senior nurses, who are managing children through the night with bronchiolitis, they are veterans because they've done 2 or 3 years looking after children with bronchiolitis. So they're, for example, they're 100% comfortable with high flow nasal cannula oxygen. And in fact, they're a little, in my opinion, a little too comfortable with it, because we use it, I think, a little too generously, which is one of the other things that the bundle attempts to use. So actually, what's been really interesting to me is how do you, when you think that management of bronchiolitis, if I've been doing this guideline iteratively for about 10 or 15 years now, actually I've gone through generations and generations of nurses. There's very few nurses who stick around in the same area for 10 years. And so actually there is this need to go out and continue to teach and go back and say, okay, so what is it we're doing here? Have we got the wrong idea? Have we gone down the wrong direction? I mean, the thing that I liken it to is lumbar punctures. I don't know what your teams are like about doing lumbar punctures, but we go through phases. Sometimes you have everybody getting a lumbar puncture. Sometimes you have barely any lumbar punctures done, or it's all every patient has declined to have the lumbar puncture done. And you kind of go through that cultural thing, and you have to keep on putting the effort in. And so that's one of the things that's really struck me here, is that actually a lot of the newest nurses are being taught by 3-year veterans.
Yeah.
And I have to remember that and go and be kind and say, yes, you do know a lot about bronchiolitis, but actually more broadly indeed than that, we need to be thinking about, this is the genuine evidence, and so this is what we're going to try this year.
Okay. So will you be publishing any of your sort of audits locally, or maybe on social media, do you think, or just to sort of see how it's got on?
Yeah, I hope to be able to give some feedback. As you say, I had a lot of interest. I've probably shared it with 10 or 15 units around the UK who've politely asked for copies of it. And hopefully if people do audit it locally, they'll share their data with me as well. I've asked them to, if they wouldn't mind. So hopefully I'll be able to give some information and some feedback and iteratively improve the bundle for next year.
Perfect. Well, Ian, that's fascinating, and I really look forward to seeing how that's gone. Thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Been an absolute pleasure. Thank you, Ian.